what Gene and others may be interested in, Planet Texas 2050, how do, and in general, how do we scale up best practices and things that are going on within relatively smaller stakeholder to researcher interactions to broader ecosystems involving interdisciplinary researchers, involving multiple stakeholders, many different pools, and so on. So that's broadly how the scope of this panel, if you will. And we have very distinguished panelists here. And I'll start with Sarah Sessing. And she's in Texas Water. And she has been working in the planning, science, engineering of water in her current role, but in her former role in groundwater planning and so on. And when I'm done with this introduction, I'll ask them to introduce themselves a bit more. But I'll start with a question which will involve Sarah. After we are done with the introductions, we'll start with a question which will involve Sarah and Jay. And on purpose, I didn't tell you what that question will be, so you'll have to react immediately, spontaneously. And then we have, let me just go from here, we have Marta Gonzalez. She is at University of California, Berkeley, in regional planning, urban sciences. And she is very well known in network science and many different areas within network science, from natural social engineered systems. So it's a pleasure to have her, especially given that, you know, how her work involves multiple stakeholders across disciplines, which is fairly rare when for most researchers. And then we have Laura from MSU, and she's in ecology. And again, she'll provide the stakeholder, the researcher perspective. One thing when I was just talking to her, is she said, I don't know the answers to any of these questions which we discussed. And I said, none of us do, so that's fine, and that's the point of this panel. And then we have Chris, who's the Chief Environmental Officer of Austin, and I was saying that, well, so that's your real stakeholder for you, along with Sarah. And we'll have this discussion around researcher, stakeholder, and see how these will work. So the kind of I wanted to start with this first question for Sarah and Jerry. But before that, let us just take about 30 seconds each for you to introduce yourselves and tell everybody anything about yourself that I have missed.
I am Marta. Is off here. Yeah. I'm Marta Gonzalez, as Arup said. My tools are network science and complex system. And as a physicist, nowadays I am in city and regional planning and civil engineering. It's a new position now. The reason of that flow is the opportunity that the data sources brought us. And my strong relation with the stakeholders were because we had the tools that convert big data, the so-called famous big data, into usable information for them. So tools from complex system, network science, and physics, with the new data sources, worked pretty well. And we were bringing what the city was needing. And in meetings like this, we can put some order. It's not about the researcher giving a task, a homework, but how can we create together sustainable urban systems? So it's a pretty much a kind of switch I'm doing in my research nowadays.
So I'm Laura Schmidt-Olavisi. I'm an ecologist, natural scientist by training, but I work in a highly interdisciplinary department now. Like a few of you here, I am a participatory modeler. So we heard what that was earlier today. It basically means that I build models of complex systems with people who live in and work in those systems for the purpose of solving problems. I work mostly in agriculture and food system issues, although I branch out to energy and natural resources too, and I work both in West Africa and in the United States.
everyone. Nice to see you again. Sarah, as Arup said, I run the Texas Water Foundation, which predominantly is focusing on kind of the confluence of the policy world, science and research, and looking at the next generation of leadership and how it is that you can help to affect that cycle. In terms of background, I have a multidisciplinary background, so what I say I actually do is translation. I like to translate across the silos, between the silos, make sure that the politicians understand what scientists are saying, make sure the scientists understand what the politicians are saying, and that's kind of my passion.
Hello everyone, my name is Chris Harrington. I am currently the City of Austin's Environmental Officer, so it sounds like a really cool title. It is a unique position at the city because it's actually created by the city code. And so the city code obligates me to ensure that environmental protection receives the highest priority in all public and private development. So that's a change in roles for me. For the last two decades, I've worked for the city's Watershed Protection Department, so we're a fee-funded municipal drainage utility, so we work on water quality, erosion, and flood hazard risk reduction issues. So I've worked on the science side, on the technical side for a long time with a fantastic group of hydrogeologists and engineers, biologists, ecologists, and foresters and planners and landscape architects on the city's water quality issues. Now I'm on the policy side, but throughout that I've been involved in lots of stakeholder processes, and I've always been questing to understand who stakeholders are, so apparently wasn't looking in the mirror. That's right.
Where are they?
All right, thank you very much, everyone. Let me now start with that question that I was going to ask. And this was from yesterday's panel that Sarah was running. Many of you were here, and I'll ask her to summarize that conversation after this, but Robert Puente and Jay, there was this conversation towards the end of that panel, I believe, when Jay was asking, how do we do something very similar to this? How do we do XYZ to make some, to ensure that, whatever we are doing with research, we can make that change, we can scale these systems, etc. And one answer that we got from Robert was that ain't going to happen. I wish I could support you. I completely see that. I would love to support you, but that ain't going to happen. Mm-hmm. Something like that. Sarah, if you could please elaborate a little bit on that conversation.
Sure. It was the truth bomb moment right before Mary Lou dropped the mic on all of us. Robert Puente, who is a former legislator, was former chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, and now runs one of the largest water utilities in the nation. The question that you're alluding to is regarding growth and whether Texas would ever reconfigure the way that it views growth in relation to resiliency and sustainability. And what Robert said was, hey, in Texas, Texas equals growth in terms of our political kind of desires and interests. And he said, I don't think that we will ever say no to growth because we spend so much of our political bandwidth discussing things like bathroom bills instead of, real issues, I think was his general comment.
And would you like to add anything to that based on your...
Yeah, I think there's a sort of another phase of that question, and how you responded to it that I asked was all these regional stakeholders are doing really good things or local and municipal. Is there any hope that it could all be coordinated sort of at a state level? Because all the things we could learn now and put into practice, given that 26 million new Texans are going to move here and we're going to expand cities and make SUS even... they'll now be LUS, right? Even larger, ELUS, even larger urban systems, right? What we could learn and implement now is going to have a really big effect if we could do it on a statewide level. So wouldn't coordinating now really be a big step? And then he crushed me. Yeah.
Right. So let's start there. We don't want G to be crushed. So let's start there. And the first question that I'd like to ask this panel and discuss is, as you think of this upscaling, or as you think of these local regional systems that work, and then how to translate them to larger systems, have they ever happened? Are there best practices based on all of your experience where you have seen these happen? And where are the gaps? So any of you who want to start, but maybe any of you from first from the stakeholder side.
I mean, so I think that what was said previously about the state taking a leadership role in this is clearly not going to happen in our current political environment. The key thing for y'all to remember is how, so a lot of innovative things do happen at the city level. I think Austin, in particular, does a lot of innovative and environmentally protective actions in terms of how we regulate the growth that's occurring. There's two key trade-offs that you have to keep in mind at all times. So municipalities are always dealing with lots of really complex different priorities. So it's when we are having conversations about homelessness and mobility and affordability, and those are what are dominating City of Austin politics right now, how do we look beyond tomorrow, beyond this budget cycle, and really go further down the road to talk about some of those impacts that we won't fully realize for generations that, like Michael was alluding to earlier. So that cities have, and that works sort of complementary to the second thing that I wanted to make. Cities have incredibly low tolerance for risk, right? So we're accountable to taxpayers. We're politically very sensitive, so we don't like negative headlines. And one of the things that media loves to do is make cities look stupid for wasting money, you know, almost more than anything else. They're always looking for that gotcha because it's a, you know, it's a titillating headline. Yeah, exactly. So how do we be innovative? How do we convince our policymakers who are beholden to their constituents to take risks, to be innovative, and to spend money? So sacrifice, we're not going to talk about spending money on affordability or mobility or homelessness, but think about how we're asking the community to give more so that a problem that we won't fully realize until they're probably dead, because a lot of our politicians also do not demographically represent the cities in the relationship. How do we get them to make those hard trade-offs? So that's a fantastic way of me not actually answering the question, but I'm just saying that to keep in mind, and I'm going to make you.
So three things occur to me. The first, in terms of Jay's comment about, wouldn't it be ideal if we were all coordinating at some larger level on all of these efforts? I have found, even within just the water world, right, which is just one subject matter, that there are so many layers of attempted coordination that are occurring that have come from the legislature at times, that have come for, that there's a little bit of apathy and exhaustion there in terms of recreating coordinating groups. I mean, how many, you probably spend, what, 50% of your week going to coordinating group meetings? So that's one thing that occurs to me in terms of that desire for coordination. Second thing is, kind of hopping on what you were saying, is regarding political will and what creates it. Robert Mace runs a group called the Water Grant Challenges, which is identifying what those central challenges are. And there was a participant earlier this week that said, well, you have to look pretty realistically at what creates political will, right? And it's the movers and the shakers, the people that are complaining, typically, right? And so in terms of how decisions are made, you know, that I think that you just have to be realistic about how political will is actually formed. And then the final thing is about priorities and values, and especially when it comes to stakeholder-run processes, and this is what we see in water policy, is that people's decisions are informed by their priorities. Their priorities are informed, in my opinion, by how it affects them. And that doesn't necessarily mean they're making the best decision, it just means they're making the best decision that they know in their particular context. And so, I think that sometimes it's hard to coordinate everybody's different competing priorities, and then how it affects political will and who has the power to affect that political will more than somebody else does.
All excellent points. Okay, well, I was gonna say, as an academic, let me bring in some theory here, right? So I think there's an argument to be made from kind of a resilience theory perspective that you want some coordination, but not hyper-synchronization or hyper-ties, right? So one of the tenets of resilience theory, which comes out of ecology, is that you kind of maximize resilience when you have loose connections, but not, you know, lockstep connections. So in other words, if you have a whole bunch of cities that are kind of trying different things, for sustainability, for solving these problems, then you have a whole bunch of experiments going on. You can learn from those experiments. You're networked enough that that knowledge can maybe spread, but if one city tries something and it's disastrous, everybody's not doing the same thing. So I think there's kind of an argument to be made that you want, you know, some maybe goal setting and networking at a very high scale, but not rigid policy set at a high scale, because that could be leading us down the wrong path, especially in a highly uncertain future, right? But I don't know.
Yes, I would like to build up on what Sarah said, that we can be working in the academia and then the decision seems to be made with the stomach or with, you know, with your tendency, political tendency. Coming from the area of natural science, of physics, now dealing with policymakers, stakeholders, the question, I mean, the dream would be, and I think somehow it's part of what we are trying to do here together, is science-informed policy. So a few things I would like to add into that direction is, one risk is, well, the challenge is that it's over complex problem. So when by the exercise we just were doing, it's like there are so many details, and the risk is those models, let's so-called AML model family, needed so much detail that what I thought that some PhD thesis, entire PhD thesis, were about calibrating the model, sort of thing. That was before, you know, remember the Los Alamos, the big agent-based simulator, millions on that, Now that we have new data sources, there is a temptation to try to cover everything. So I want to emphasize that if the goal is science-informed policy, our tendency to model humans, we're terrible to model humans because we want to know the whys of everything. So we may need to rethink the way we use information to inform policy, simplifying the process so that we are more effective. And the second thing I want to add, the second challenge I've seen in this field is the tragedy of the commons. So basically everybody has seen that, so we are competing for space in our housing, how much we can pay, our commuting time, the mode we take, and we are selfish optimizing for our common good. I think the communication with human source that we go into collective behavior towards social good is what I see the opportunity of information. So it seems to be a hopeless case because we are selfish humans trying to optimize our benefits. However, when we are talking about the common good environment, it may be an opportunity to tie policy, humans, and natural systems, hopefully new ways. So those are my 2 points.
Thank you so much. So it's interesting that Marta, you mentioned science-informed policy, or there could be policy-informed science, there could be co-design of policy and science, and we have been hearing that a little bit also. In terms of going to next steps, then, so we sort of got a feel for the gaps and the best practices to some extent, and some interesting background from the physics and from biology about bringing in theory. Theory reminds me, by the way, in some discussions like this, maybe a few years back, a lot of people talk about game theory from economics perspective. It's interesting that, you know, I mean, how those ideas have been evolving. But anyway, getting to incentives, what can we do? I mean, first of all, are there disincentive structures right now? Like they say in the area of infrastructure resilience, there are some disincentives. Financial disincentive structures built in. So in here, in terms of scaling up, are there some existing disincentive structures? Could incentives be built both for researchers and for stakeholders, potentially, to make this happen? So I think you are already thinking about something, so would you want to share your thoughts?
Yeah, my very first thought was the lobby. Scared of lobbyists. One of the, you know, as you're talking about science-informed policy or policy-informed, you know, back and forth, the experience that I've had in Texas, and a lot of us within the water policy spaces, there's a, it's almost an easy excuse that when legislators don't want to do something, they go, well, you just need to focus on the best available science. best available science. You know, but the, what's unfortunate is that when you're making a policy decision, particularly when it comes to resource allocation, there is no science that tells you how to allocate those resources. That is a policy decision, which is complex, right? So I think there's a little bit of a tendency to say, well, if you have the science right, well, then everything will be ABC, it'll make sense. Well, no, that's not how it goes at all. But people like to lean on it real hard as, well, you have the best available science, you'll know the right solution. And that's not how it works.
Yeah, so true. So interacting with politicians at the state, county, and city level on a routine basis, they do not make decision based on policy or data or fact. It's politics, right? And so kind of going back to what was said before, that's just a reflection of the stakeholders they choose to listen to and their value system. So looking to government to solve this problem, you're not going to get anywhere, I promise you. And so many of the decisions I have to make with an engineering background and a biology background and a team of scientists behind me on a routine basis, I have to make decisions and recommendations in a complete gray area. And so again, I'm trying to be reflective of a certain value that I understand the city council and in making policies. But it is, I think we have to think about the community values and how we are engaging a broader stakeholder group to then actually drive larger scale decision making. To scale this up is about not only figuring out or having the community values be reflected in the information we're providing and how we're providing it, but then getting that communicated at all different levels, if that makes any sense at all.
Okay, I'm going to make a comment as I pass it over. I think part of the way for that not to feel so hopeless is to identify your key stakeholders that drive political will. So for example, I'm really interested in figuring out how corporate ambassadors can suddenly turn political pressure to make it so that you look at water strategies, right? So I think it's about being really smart about which stakeholders you have going speaking to your policymakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you guys make excellent points that I mean, I'm an outside observer, but seem very true to me. So, I mean, I think a couple things here. First of all, I think it's important to remember that decisions are made in a wide variety of contexts across society, right, that affect natural resources. So legislative policy is one, you know, and we hear that there's political issues involved there. People make decisions in their daily lives having to do with money. You know, people make decisions on a neighborhood scale. People are making decisions, you know, institutionally, like you talked about corporations, you know, nonprofits. There's all kinds of opportunities to bring information to people to help them make better decisions that is not just influencing policy that moves through the legislative process. So that's one thing. I also, you know, just want to take a little bit of a step back and say, just, I think everybody has to ask this question for themselves in terms of what's their personal philosophical or moral stance on how they interact with the policy process. But for me as a scientist, I always come into things feeling like it is not my job to tell people what they should do or what they should care about. That is a process that should take place, you know, in a democratic way. And it's my job to help inform the trajectory that people say they want to accomplish with the expertise that I can bring in that's relevant. I have a problem with entering into a space, and by virtue of the fact that I have a PhD, I get to say what people should do, and that voice carries more weight than, say, a single mother living on the south side of Detroit with three children. You know what I mean? Like, my voice should not count more. So my job is to help facilitate the information sharing and the science around, you know, the democratic process of deciding what should be done in a given community or society. That's my philosophical view. And Moira is itching to say something. Yeah.
May I?
Please.
Just to plant it there as something to think about. I completely agree with you. You know I do, right?
Yep.
At the same time, I'm thinking marketing. Businesses have no problem telling you what you should think and what you should do, right? Why are we, that's not a level playing field. So how do we handle that? Because I mean, we have all this influence coming from the private sector through marketing, and we don't want to do that because we don't want to bias or to impose our own visions, because we have that, you know, that ethic, which I agree with. But we have this other stuff going on that really influences, right, what we do. So
I would even take it further. Like our political decision-making process has been infiltrated by folks who the exact opposite of you are not acting ethically and do represent themselves as scientific experts or engineering experts, but are most certainly not relying on the best available scientific information when they very strongly advocate a specific position for which they're being paid, generally by someone who will benefit by a decision being made to that. So, like, it's fantastic that, you know, we talk about being ethical, but I kid you not, because I testify against them on a regular basis. Yes. The other side is not.
Yeah. And I would just add on to that, I mean, to also your point, Maria, about, so, you know, before my life in academia, I used to work at the Oak Ridge National Lab, and, you know, I sort of convinced myself, like you were saying, each person needs to convince themselves about these stance based on Roger Pilke Jr.'s Honest Broker and so on and so forth, that as a scientist, I should stay completely out of any of these, you know, I mean, even influencing any sort of, you know, activism or anything like that, not because I don't feel anything, but because, you know, it gives a biased perspective. But then, you know, after joining academia, and it's been a while now, each year I take my students out to various parts of the world to study climate effects and so on. And my students have asked me, when we have been discussing this question, and they are the ones who are going to feel a lot of the impact, but professor, if you are in the top floor of a tall building, and if you see the flood approaching, and others who are downstairs don't feel that, don't you have an obligation to tell them that a flood is coming? I have no answer for that yet.
Well, I just want to clarify that that's not exactly what I mean. So, yes, I do think scientists, you know, as scientists, we're aware of the potential impacts of climate change, which are severe. We absolutely have a responsibility to say that and reflect that. And that, I think, is entirely supportable. What I don't think we do is have, in my opinion, right, so this is just me talking as my, you know, I don't think we should then say, okay, climate change is a serious problem, we all have to address it, and here specifically is the way that I want you to do it, because, you know, this is my personal opinion about how it should be done, right? Because I think that should be a democratic process. So I think those two things are slightly different.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, building
up
on top of what has been said, is eye-opening, and I think almost a responsibility for us about the situation with legislation versus knowledge. To tell one example, how are the legislation regarding building housing? And it turns out that there was a law proposed for California, the entire state, on allowing to build higher density constructions. And a student came as a friend of the class and brought this, and the way it was informed, the regulation of where to build or not, it was based on the headway between buses. So you would take that as a point. So if you have enough buses frequency coming to a place above a threshold, there you can build a high. That could be an example of a very relevant legislation, because it's going to affect cost of living. And that information on the data of how things are calculated, the impact, meaning the knowledge that would support the legislation or not, was not put into the open space for us, the experts, to try to come out. That law hasn't passed, and it brings us back to the common good. When you tell a person that already have solved the problem of housing and is an owner, they don't want higher constructions, right? Then it brings us back to legislation, knowledge, and our selfish interest. That is one example of, okay, we are somehow stuck, perhaps. I mean, the hope close it in a green way is if we are not affecting legislators directly, we can affect political opinion by writing the books, making, you know, through NSF. Imagine we have these projects going into the relevant study cases that would create knowledge through students and publications and books, hopefully to see attendance. The news is a slow process, as I can see.
Can I ask you a question? there was a book that came out a few years ago. I think the author was Andrew Kaufman. And it was, the title was something to the effect of like how culture shapes climate change or something to that effect. And one of the premises, it's a very short book, very non-academically written. And one of the premises is that academia actually has a responsibility also in creating an exclusivity where people who are not academics are unable to access the conversation, and therefore creating this polarized feeling of well, you know, so think about climate change specifically, right? So I don't know. I guess that's not a question. It's a comment, but it's
yeah,
a question.
Right,
it's a,
right.
it's a well, yeah, it's a question in terms of academically thinking about how do you create relevant material that helps inform the conversation rather than continuing to divide and polarize.
Right, and ironically, that leads to exactly that dynamic that you were talking about. You know, where it's like I'm the expert, so like clearly what I say is like what you should do. You know, and I think that in you know, maybe unintentionally, we almost set that up, that we give people with PhDs like a greater clout to say something that people are going to listen to. So ironically, maybe by democratizing this more, we actually would have a better and less polarized debate.
And it's not as if we are doing that well, right, with that kind of environment.
Not here.
Not right. Yes, please.
I would just make the point, I worked at the kind of science and legislative interface in Texas for about 20 years, and when a scientist expresses a policy preference, you've just expressed a bias, and it draws into question your science, because you've expressed a policy preference, and then and politicians have a nose for what your bias. I mean, they're getting worked over all the time, and they can tell if the scientist is there just to give them the facts versus the scientist giving them the facts, but then also telling them what they should do. In my experience, you know, it works great to tell a politician what they should do if what you think they should do is what they already think they should do. But it's not a good thing when it goes against what they're doing and they're not open to listening.
That sucks that it discredits your science when you say, hey, P.S., the flood is coming, which in Texas is a really good analogy.
To me, the flood is coming, that's a fact. I mean,
for some politicians, it's not a fact. I mean, if they don't want to believe it, they're telling you that you're biased.
But as a scientist, you can say that. And, you know, you can't help what people are thinking.
Right.
Or what politicians are thinking. Now, if you say, here's what you need to be doing for the flood, you know, in that political realm, then you get into trouble.
So,
unless you're looking at different, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this,
right.
You can do this.
I think that's the point, and just again, like just showing the trade-offs, but I think that, again, just to be aware of the broader context that we're working within, with a lot of, you know, pressure put in, and a lot of resources put into marketing and lobbying that goes against, you know, essentially what our scientific research is showing, right? And it's not, again, about telling people what they should do, because that is nobody's role, actually. They should do whatever, you know, the idea is that we have freedom within certain constraints, right? But the thing is that we are operating in that environment, and so what I wanted to address, given the theme of the panel, is given that that's what we're working against, because it is against, how do we scale these partnerships up, right? And really transform and further strengthening our democracy by, you know, just disseminating or, if you will, marketing what we do and what we're finding out.
So I think do you want to say something? So I'll come to that in a minute. No, I'll come to you in a minute, actually. Right? So let's take it from there. So we have heard the challenges, the gaps, best practices, potential incentives, what we want to do. I was thinking of metrics. Could we say that, okay, here is how much progress we have made, here is where we want to go. Could we define some set of metrics, key performance indicators, quantitative, qualitative, causal diagrams, whatever it is, which gives us, okay, this is where you want to go. Are we even going in the right direction? Is the sign of the change what we want? And can we continuously then monitor it and improve it? And here, maybe let's go the other side. What would theory tell us, like you're saying, maybe, in terms of ecology, in terms of resilience, but also from there going to participatory models? So maybe Laura, and then you can say a little bit about that, right, in terms of, and then Marta, from your side, and then let's go to the
stakeholders, if those are even, you know, applicable or, you know,